Welcome to Break Fake Rules. I'm your host, Glenn Gallich. In this episode, I sit down with my friend, Carmen Rojas, CEO of the Marguerite Casey Foundation, on Zoom. So you'll notice the sound quality is less pristine than our usual in-person episodes. But that doesn't take away from the brilliant insights Carmen has to share. Take a listen. Welcome to Break Fake Rules. Some rules are meant to be broken. And when you break some rules, especially the fake ones, it tends to make society a better place. And that's what we're here to talk about with one of the great thinkers and doers in the philanthropic sector, Ms. Carmen Rojas, joining us here via Zoom, which I understand is what all the kids are using these days. How's it going,
Carmen?
That's
what they say. You know, that's what they say, Glenn. And since this is going to be recorded, look at this.
Look at you. Look at how you do. That's amazing. Nice work.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just so everybody knows, I met Carmen about 20 years after everybody else did, but about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And I saw you on stage talking at a conference. And I was really impressed with how you were looking at advocacy. And you had just, what we did not know is that you were considering a transition from an organization you founded, Workers Lab, and made your way to today where you're leading the Marguerite Casey Foundation. There's so many ways I want to go into this, but let's talk about, I would say, one of the major fake rules that Marguerite Casey Foundation has broken. And I know the story as to why this happened, so I don't want to romanticize it, but one of the big differences, you have grantees, you have community leaders and activists on your board. And if I'm right, you don't have one family member.
That's right.
I thought that in all of these family foundations and private foundations, it's about the family. It's about what the family needs. The rule is center the donor. Yeah. What's going on with Marguerite Casey? Why did this happen? Why are you breaking this fake rule?
Can I add some fake rules to your fake rule?
Oh man, there's so many. I don't even want to try to stop here.
So there is center the family. So you need to have a family member on a board to be effective or to meet a charitable purpose. You have to have a corporate representative or somebody with a deep commitment to corporate capitalism on your board to be a legitimate institution. You need to have somebody who is steeped in understanding what legal risk looks like. So, and somebody on your board that understands what that means from a reputational perspective more than a community impact perspective. And I was lucky. I came into an institution that never had family board members, never had corporate representatives. Marguerite Casey is a part of the Casey family of foundations founded by Jim Casey, who led UPS forever until it went public. And we were the last established institution. And from our founding, never had a family tie or a corporate tie on our board. And when I joined the foundation, we had 7 people retire from the board. And it created a real opening for me to think about what kind of information, perspective, understanding would be most helpful for me to do this job. And it was really the understanding, perspective, and knowledge that comes from leading institutions, grantee institutions, leading public institutions. And so over the last 3 years, we've brought on scholars like Megan Ming Francis, who isn't just a scholar, but is a scholar of the ways in which social movements have been captured by philanthropy and how philanthropy can often distort the mandate and charitable meaning and purpose and founding of nonprofit organizations. Political leaders like Julian Castro and Stacey Abrams on our board, because I understand that our political system is deeply impacting the communities that we hope to serve. So to have 2 people like them on the board is helpful for me, for us to understand context. And then to have leaders of national racial justice organizations like Rashad Robinson from Color of Change, Marisa Franco from Mi Gente, to have them on our board so that we have a sense of what it means to run an organization. So we're never so far away from our grant recipients that we start to turn our nose down at their struggles, or it forces us to have a level of clarity and transparency in our grant making work that otherwise I don't think we would be able to make. So it is a fake rule, and that is how we broke it.
And what benefit? Well, you've already gone through a few of the benefits of it. Let's look at it this way. If you had a family member on the board who had very little experience with the issue areas you're in, or you're not even really in a specific issue area, you're looking to really do your best to recenter power in communities that typically had it taken away, how would that affect, in your view, the way you operate as a foundation?
Yeah, you know, I've been on the board of family foundations of entirely of family members, worked for family foundations. And there are a couple of things that are always so striking to me about those experiences. One, this assumed transference of knowledge that comes from wealth, right? That because I have a bunch of money, I know a bunch of things. And that's just not true. There's like a real lack of curiosity and understanding that comes from mass wealth transfer. And frankly, it's because our society has said that you clearly have a lot of money, you must know a lot of things. And there's really little to no check in that. Massaging of ego. I think with living donors, there's a lot of managing towards individual feelings as opposed to managing towards collective impact, as opposed to solidarity.
But Carmen, I think you're being really unfair. So let me give the devil's advocate position. Isn't this their money? So shouldn't they be able to do it the way they want to do it? And shouldn't they be able to do things like get their kids involved in philanthropy and help build a legacy for a family that has done so much for a community?
Yeah, you know, I'm clear that charity and justice are not the same thing. And I'm clear that rich people in this country have gotten rich because we have, in the words of Matt Desmond, accepted private opulence and public squalor. That rich people in this country have found ways to keep money at the expense of our collective well-being. So it's not as if the rich people and families hand this money off again and again and again and again for an entirely altruistic purpose. They do it because they get a tax break, right? Like, and we exist as Marguerite Casey Foundation because UPS went public and a gift was made. And that gift allowed for a tax break. We only see one side of the story, which is the giving of money, but not the getting of money. And for me, it's so incomplete to try to say, this is your money. That's actually my money. It's our money. It's money that's not in our public system. We exist because our public systems, and specifically the IRS and our tax system, but across the board, have decided that it is better to keep the money in the hands of a small number of people as opposed to put it into our public systems to ensure that we have high quality K through college education for everybody. And to ensure that if I get sick or you get sick or if anybody in our community gets sick, they can go to see a doctor without going broke, without going into debt.
Right.
It's our money. It's our money. And it's our money not only because of the tax break, it's our money because oftentimes it's in public institutions and the investments that public institutions make through subsidy, through R&D, that corporations and individuals within corporations are able to amass so much wealth.
Right, right. I mean, I try to play devil's advocate, but I'm right there with you.
The devil doesn't need an attorney, Glenn. The devil doesn't need an attorney.
Well said, well said, well said. But if he did, I guess I was just playing it. let's get into something that you and I debate on occasion. And that is something I am a big fan of, which is seeing far fewer foundations on the planet if we can get there, which means they're all going to need to spend down at some point. They're going to need to spend away. So my question to you is, you know, what is your view on spending down? This foundation that I work with is a spend down. I know you don't necessarily look at it that way. You see a challenge in the spend down concept. What is that?
I would be open to spend down if we had clear examples of spend up. And frankly, like right now we're in this weird moment where we do have a clear example of spend up, of public spend up. We're seeing the largest federal investment into communities across this country ever in US history. And I think it's important to note that a number of foundations across the country have supported the kind of organizing that led to this massive public investment. And so I have a real reluctance to put myself or to put Marguerite Casey Foundation in a position to spend down because I don't see the spend up. It feels like an asymmetrical solution. And because we go away doesn't mean that billionaires cease to exist. Like when billionaires cease to exist, when the Koch brothers and the Waltons, when our opposition is actually legally barred from funding the kind of thinking on the nonprofit side that has become so common sense, then I would be okay with this going away. When there is a clear like regulatory regime that makes you being a rich person or leading a rich institution not having disproportionate weight or insight or power over how people live their lives, then I would be okay with going away. That's just not the reality that we're in right now. And I feel like we're at the apex of a struggle around that. And I will also just say, like, I see philanthropy, especially progressive or left philanthropy, as creating bubbles of oxygen in a moment in which there is very little oxygen in our atmosphere, and where leaders of organizations, scholars, researchers are constantly under attack, being able to provide a small bit of money because money matters to a scholar, to an organization, to a community, just creates a little bit, creates, I believe, at least a bit of a buoy in this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an unfair question to ask you because you are running such a unique foundation these days, unfortunately. You're a unique foundation. So I think it's an unfair question. But what I would say is, there are 125,000 private foundations in America. And I believe the statistics, sometimes I get statistics wrong, but I believe about 40 to 50% of them are at 50 million or more in assets. So they're staffed probably, they're quite large relatively, they're making lots of grants. So that total amount of money is somewhere in the range of about $1 trillion. And if 95% of that is invested in what I would call counter mission activity. I know your foundation is looking to align what you're going to be invested in for the purposes of perpetuity with your grant making. But that's, you're an oddity if you're trying to do that. So I think we're taking a dramatic risk with all the good we're trying to do when we have $1 trillion roughly invested in counter mission activity within the foundation sector. And on top of it, a focus on what I've been referring to as perpetuity over humanity. Mm-hmm. The thing I kind of play with all the time in my head is, what if Carmen Rojas had $500 billion, like very Dr. Evil here, $500 billion worth of capital to work with in one 10-year period? Mm-hmm. How dramatically could you affect the movement and organizing world over that 10-year period? And what would that effect be on government, on communities for the long term? A massive infusion of systemic intervention.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like you answered the question for me, Glenn. Like our endowment work, we are just as aggressive about our endowment work as we are about our grant making. And like, I think that there are a couple of X factors that could be throwaways that I don't want to be throwaways. So we have, you know, 15 staff, 16 staff now at Marguerite Casey Foundation. And we as an organization, as a leadership team, as a board, have decided not to make the business of giving away money some magic mystery where we need a staff of 200 people, because that's just untrue. Many of our institutions have built up entire enterprises around themselves. And I just don't believe that that's necessary. I'm like, we're going to try some things. We're going to support some organizations. We're going to do it in the long term. We're going to be clear. We're going to be overly communicative. We're going to give people real money. So in our community grant making work, it's 25% of an organization's budget for up to 5 years. Do that in a way that we don't have an evaluations team to figure out impact. Because how do you evaluate voting accessibility in southern states? Like, what a, we're with $500,000, like let's have a reasonable conversation about what that means. So like, that's one thing that I think is important about us. I feel like we try to do things differently here, mostly because there's a gift to giving away money, frankly, and to be able to sort of plant seeds, create these little bubbles of oxygen for folks on the front lines of these fights feels like a privilege. And we want to treat it as such and don't want to build an institution that's just organized around our individual legacy or whatever, but instead actually be able to be in relationships with labor leaders who are fighting across the country, with racial justice leaders that are fighting across the country, with scholars who are fighting across the country for a more just future.
All right, so let me pivot us here a little bit. You just kind of let us into it. One of the fake rules, I think, which is pretty dominant in how most foundations operate, is they see philanthropy, like you said earlier, like charity. And so I define that as the band-aid for where government services stop. So a lot of foundations are giving grants for the purposes of greater or higher volume service to constituents who are not being served by the government. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there's kind of like a McDonald land statistic thing here where you're trying to figure out how many constituents have been served by our philanthropy. Mm-hmm. This is not the way you look at philanthropy. This rule you have broken.
Yeah.
So tell us more, if you don't mind, about the Marguerite Casey theory of change.
Yeah. I think for far too long, we have come to accept, and this is like from liberals to conservatives, we've accepted a norm. We've accepted as common sense this belief that government doesn't work and shouldn't work for us, and that a smaller government is better than a bigger government, than a more robust and safety net providing government, and that the private sector actually is better poised to meet people's needs than the public sector. And as we have been as a sector hyper invested in everything from charter schools to nonprofit housing, on the public sector side, three things have happened. One is that the government doesn't feel the need to provide it anymore. We're like, public housing sucks. I'd rather live in affordable housing. No, actually, we should demand better public housing for everybody. So on the one side, government has just stopped investing in it. We have made normal, and this is a cross-partisan, this is not just a Republican, this is a Democratic endeavor as well. The second thing that I think is more pernicious is that rich people, leaders of corporations, donors who establish foundations like this, come to believe that we are able to take the place of government, that we have a mandate, that we are accountable, and we're not. We are private institutions.
Yeah.
When a foundation or a nonprofit provides something, it is the same kind of privatization as when a corporation and a private actors provide it. It may feel better, but it is still privatizing a public good. Mm. And the third and the most pernicious for me, Glenn, is that we start to, in people's imagination, limit their expectations and belief that our government should be working for them. And so then everyday people are like, of course government sucks because there's no housing in my neighborhood. Of course government sucks because every library is closed. Of course government sucks because I have to bus my kid 30 miles away from where we live to make sure that they go to a good K through 12 school, or I have to send them to private school. Of course government sucks. And we all pay taxes. And so there is no greater mandate, I think, for a foundation than to start to reset these three things. Make sure that people understand that government works. So in Seattle, we have been supporting this amazing, the Seattle Solidarity Budget, which essentially brings people along in the budget making of the city of Seattle. This is your money. How would you like to spend it? What are your priorities in your community? So bringing people in along in the rulemaking, being able to support them as they start to advocate for government to provide more of these resources for them. So throughout the South, we fund an organization called Southern Economic Advancement Project that's helping communities access these federal dollars and training people in cities and organizations to understand like the rulemaking of how to get these dollars. But frankly, like most importantly, for me at least, is being able to provide a competitive public option for private goods, right? Like the state of California on insulin, right? Like the fact that the state of California is providing insulin, that is the perfect example of competing with a shitty private option with a quality public good for something that people need to live. And so as an institution, that's where we're living. We're naming government as a key protagonist in shaping the way that we live, and not as our opposition, not wanting it to be smaller, not talking our way out of it, but instead making them the target of our dreams and aspirations.
Wow. You know, you just had a whole spiel there that I wish we could spend 2 hours on, but we're, you know, what have we picked up on? There's some big fake rules that you're pushing against, which is why I love you and I love working with you on so many things. Number one, really going after this issue of communifying your board, making sure that you've got players in the game who really understand the needs of the communities that you're trying to work with. Second thing is looking at government as a provider of great service and making sure that it's responsive to the communities that it serves. And that requires those communities being in a place to demand the kind of services that they should and not have to rely on the private option all the time. Just a couple of big ones right there. Just knocking fake rules all over the place. It's always great to work with you, Carmen. Thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great.
Thanks so much for having me, Glenn.
Next time on Break Fake Rules, hear from Rachel Pritzker, a democracy and climate change philanthropist and chair of the Democracy Funders Network. She'll talk about her role as a donor building coalitions and countering polarization on some of the most contentious issues our country is facing.
Always be challenging. A, B, C. That's how new ideas arise.
Yeah.
We don't come up with innovation and new ideas by just repeating the same stuff to each other.
Thank you for tuning in to Break Fake Rules. This show is brought to you by the Stupski Foundation, where we are returning all our resources to the communities we call home in Hawaii and the San Francisco Bay Area by 2029. Our producer extraordinaire is Claire Callahan. The show is mixed and edited by Patrick Childers of Odd Conduit Media. Special thanks to our videographers and visual production team who fly from all over the world to be a part of this, Steve Johnson and Brooke Van Dam of Sea Boundless. Subscribe to the Stupski Foundation YouTube channel to watch videos of each episode. You can find us on YouTube by searching Stupski Foundation. We hope these conversations don't end here, so join the conversation with me on LinkedIn.